you have to have those disagreements. You have to have debate. Like, what are we trying to do? What does the audience want to see? What do we want them to feel in this moment? If you don't have all of that sort of debate, dissent, disagreement, friction, you're not going to produce the best possible product.
Hey, it's Zach here, and super quick before we dive into the show. If you haven't already, I want to make sure that you have subscribed to my free weekly Case of the Mondays newsletter, because it is where I share my best advice, strategies, and mindsets to help you design a creative career that you absolutely love showing up for every Monday morning. When you sign up, I'll even send you a bonus 5-day email course to help you clarify and prioritize the next small steps in your unique path to success. To sign up, just visit optimizeyourself.me/newsletter. All right, on to today's episode. My name is Zach Arnold, and I'm a former Hollywood film and television editor turned career strategist and the creator of Optimize Yourself, where I help artists, creatives, and storytellers just like you design the more balanced, more sustainable, and more fulfilling creative career that you deserve. In a nutshell, I'm Tim Ferriss meets Ted Lasso, minus the mustache, because I am obsessed with both learning everything I can about optimizing human potential while also inspiring you to realize yours. If you are ready to step outside your comfort zone, let's dive right in and unlock the optimized version of you. Hello, and welcome to the Optimize Yourself podcast, where I share honest and candid conversations with best-selling authors, world-class athletes, Hollywood legends, elite experts in a variety of fields, as well as everyday people that are achieving extraordinary things. It means the world to me that with all the podcast choices out there, you have chosen to invest your valuable time, energy, and attention with me. Now, before we get started, don't forget to visit optimizeyourself.me/podcast so you can subscribe, leave a review, and so you can also download your unique customized podcast playlist, where I'm going to send you the 5 best expert interviews from our archives to help you achieve your specific goals. So on that note, without further ado, let's get right to today's guest. I'm here today with Amy Gallo, and she is a workplace expert whose advice has been featured in little known publications like, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and Fast Company, just to name a very, very select few. You're also the author of the latest book, Getting Along, How to Work with Anyone, Even Difficult People. And you're also the co-host of Harvard Business Review's Women at Work podcast. Amy, it is a tremendous pleasure after all the back and forth to finally have you on Zoom and record this conversation with you today.
Yeah, it's so great to be here. And isn't it amazing when something takes months and months to happen and it happens? It feels so good.
Yes, that's the story of my life. All these visions and ideas, and they're going to happen someday in the future. And then all of a sudden you're like, weren't we talking about this like 9 months ago? And here we are, we finally made it happen. So very excited about this. So I'm actually going to frame the beginning of this conversation from a conversation that I just had with my wife last night. She and I went out to dinner, and on the way home, my wife said, what are you reading right now? And I've got a whole stack of books that I'm going through, and I've got 4 podcast interviews this week alone. But I had mentioned that I'm reading this book about getting along with difficult people. And her question was, why would you be reading that? And I realized, I'm not sure I have a really succinct answer. And then the answer just came to me, and it just happened to come to me on page 22 of your book. So I'm gonna share this passage as a way to kind of frame where I really want to go today. And you mentioned that the research is clear. If you want to thrive at work, if you want to perform your best, if you want to be engaged and productive, and you want to think creatively and expansively, you have to pay attention to your relationships. I talk about relationships all the time, ad nauseum, which is very ironic given that I am an extreme introvert, but I believe that the quality of your life is dictated by the quality of your relationships. And I've been teaching relationship building and networking for years, but I've never really talked about relationships from the angle of how it enhances or detracts from creativity or productivity. So that's essentially the crux of today's conversation. But where I actually want to start is asking a simpler, maybe not as simple a question as it might sound, but the simple question is, what led you to say, I'm going to spend my entire life and my career dealing with conflict and difficult people all day, every day?
Can I give a 2-word answer?
Yes.
Divorced parents, which is actually not true, but I did grow up with witnessing conflict and witnessing what happens when relationships fall apart and how you repair them and how you build other types of relationships that matter and that fulfill your life and that help you. You know, the sort of more professional career answer is that I worked as a management consultant for a strategy and organization firm in New York many years ago. And what I found is, you know, all my colleagues were drawn to strategy. How do we build a strategy for this company? How do we get these executives to agree on this? And I was sitting in those rooms just watching how people interacted. And I remember this one particular project I was on where we spent a ton of time, obviously a ton of money, getting this organization a new strategy. And we had an all-day session with the senior leaders at this company to hash out sort of the final details, put everything in place. And I remember walking out and saying to my colleagues, that's not going to work. Those people are not getting along. It doesn't matter what's on paper. It doesn't matter how much money and resources and how much smarts they have, because they were incredibly smart people, but they could not navigate conflict. They could not navigate their differences. And it was clear that those sort of fractures in those relationships were really going to plummet the strategy. So, you know, I have always been sort of drawn to this topic, but I think it was around that time that I realized this is exactly as you said, this isn't like the icing on the cake, right? Like the relationships aren't a positive benefit you get from work. They are the work, and it dictates whether you make something amazing or whether you all walk away tail between your legs, ashamed of what happened.
It's funny you say that, because I just had a conversation recently that most likely by the time I release this, these two will be paired together. Talking with Chris Deaver, who wrote the book Brave Together, talking all about this process of co-creation and talking about, you know, creatively how we're usually in all these silos and we're kind of doing our own work, and how the best ideas really come from co-creation. We didn't talk much about conflict, but I think that I want to get more into that today. But I would guess that the 25-year-old version of me, and I'm not going to date myself, but it was a ways, it was a long time ago, the 25-year-old version of me and a lot of the people that are listening today, we would classify ourselves as the people that would say, give me four walls, take the windows away, don't bother me and let me do my thing. That's when I do my best creative work. And I realized how much that was actually hindering my creativity, but I figured I don't really work well with people. I'm horrible at working for people, and my best ideas come when I'm left alone. So tell me all the reasons that I'm wrong about that.
Well, you are wrong. and it's partly because you can come up in that dark, sad room. I'll call it sad. I'm an introvert too, but it is sad to envision it. You can come up with amazing ideas, and you may actually, you know, come up with your best idea in that room, but to execute it, to get from the idea, from the vision, to actually creating something requires other people. It's this notion of this lone genius in a room producing something. I mean, even a book, right? Thinking about the book. Did I sit at this desk here and spend hours and hours by myself generating words and, you know, editing and all of that? Absolutely. But that book did not get into your hands, did not get onto the shelves of bookstores or, you know, available on Amazon by myself. There were so many people who touched it, and I had to have relationships with every single one of those people. And even the process of creating the book, I worked with two different editors. I can name five trusted advisors who I would go to when I would say, I don't know what's going on with chapter 3. I'm really stuck. It is rare that we can actually sit alone somewhere and produce the best work. And, you know, anyone who's been part of a fun, constructive brainstorming process really knows that it's the best idea didn't start as the best idea. It started as an idea that had some potential, and someone built it on it, and someone critiqued it, and someone else pushed it even further and then put a different frame on it and then brought it back two steps, right? Those ideas just don't come spewing out of someone's brain or mouth or hands. They have to be molded, and you have to have relationships. And I would argue you have to have conflict in order to make them as good as you want them to be.
Yeah. And this is a process that I've learned over many years, again, going back to my 20 or 25 year old self. I was convinced, as me, at least in my previous life, I was a film and television editor. So I always had it in my mind, and I know this is so common for other people that do similar work. I am the only one that sees all the materials. I see all the moving parts. There's a whole team creating all the different individual pieces, but I see all of them. It comes into me, and I put together what we would call my editor's cut. It's like what you would call your first draft of a manuscript, right? Here's my editor's cut. The younger version of me was, this is the best version that there is because I'm the only one that's seen everything. So I know these are the best combinations, right? Now I see it as this is the absolute best possible version of the first really shitty draft, right? I don't think the first shitty draft can be any better than this, but it's still a piece of shit. And I need help from others to make it better. So one of the processes that I've honed and refined now that I'm building a business and I've got a team is I do the exact same thing I always used to do. I go in a room and I stare at a wall all day long, and it's now a whiteboard, and I draw a bunch of stuff on and ideas, and I come to them and I say, all right, here's the idea. It totally and completely sucks. Now let's make it better. So the seed of the idea, my process is the same, but my mindset of the idea is done and fleshed out, let's execute, has changed to now let's start talking about making the idea better and let's turn it into our idea so it's no longer my idea. That's kind of my own learning process over the last 20 years.
Yeah. And I mean, I went through a similar learning process of, one of the best gifts I've given my teenage daughter is the embracing of the first draft. Because when I was her age, she's 17, when I was her age, I would just type out my essay and just be like, done. It's perfect, right? No editing, no. And it wasn't really until late in my career, but later than I'd like to admit, that I started being edited by professional editors. And I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, no. Not only were first drafts not even like close to finished, but they were really shitty. And it's that process of the back and forth, even if it's just comments in a Word doc, right? Or for you, sort of the piecing together of all the elements. But you have to have that back and forth with people. You have to have those disagreements. You have to have debate. Like, what are we trying to do? What does the audience want to see? What do we want them to feel in this moment? If you don't have all of that sort of debate, dissent, disagreement, friction, you're not going to produce the best possible product.
So I realize that the easiest answer to my next question is just get the book. So I'm very aware of that, right? But off the top of your head, I'm curious, can you think of kind of any seminal research or a statistic that you just find you've memorized and use over and over and over when somebody asks the question, like, can you actually prove to me that relationships lead to better collaboration and creativity?
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, this is one that sticks out in my head all the time, which is that and it's not directly related to creativity, but I think it really shows the power of positive relationships, which is a team of researchers at Rutgers looked at people who said they had a best friend at work and then compared the people who said yes and people who said no, looked at their performance reviews. People who said they had a best friend at work were far more likely to have positive performance reviews. And in fact, I think they even gave them a rating. It was like several points higher. And so we know that we perform better when we have people who we feel support us, who we get along with. And those relationships are critical in sort of pushing us to think differently. And I think that's, and then you can look at these flip sides. So Chris Porath, who's a professor now at University of North Carolina, who studies incivility at work, she has tons and tons of research that shows the damage that's done, not only to our productivity, but certainly to our creativity, not only when we experience incivility, so rudeness, harsh comments, dismissiveness, but also when we witness it. So you don't even have to be the target of it. If you just witness two people have a rude conversation, it dampens your creativity. So there's so much research that shows us. The one study I'll mention is the backpack study in the book. And it's this notion that it's about stress, which I think, of course, is connected to creativity and to productivity, which is that if you take two people, put them at the bottom of a hill, put a bunch of rocks in a backpack and ask them to put it on. If they're standing there alone and you ask them to look up the top of the hill and estimate how heavy the backpack is, they will say it's much heavier if they're alone than if they're with a friend, Right. So that positive, again, that positive relationship, that interaction makes us feel like the load is lighter. What better way to free us up to produce our best work than to reduce that sort of stress and anticipation?
Yeah, I love this image of the literal backpack being filled with rocks. The reason being is that one of my passions has been Spartan races for over 10 years and American Ninja Warrior. So I'm literally physically putting myself and my students in the worst conditions imaginable, because I believe that we have to train for adversity, because when adversity comes for us, which it has done at a mass scale, we have to be ready for it. And I've seen over and over and over the difference between me trying to train on my own, which is my default state. I just leave me alone and let me do my own thing, and how much physically stronger I am. And like, I can literally get more reps of push-ups or pull-ups or whatever it might be when I'm surrounded by groups. I mean, it was a mesmerizing thing for me to realize that I think this is my maximum number of pull-ups. And then all of a sudden I'm in front of a group and I'm like, oh my God, I did like 20% more. Where did that energy come from? And to be able to apply that to the collaborative and the creative process has also been mesmerizing, which is why I do my best to get out of the small, dark, or as you say, the sad room as much as I can.
Well, and I work with a coach, and she has told me for 2 years, has been drilling into my head, when you feel overwhelmed, the first question you ask is, who can help? It's still hard for me to do. It happened this week. It happened on Tuesday, where I was totally overwhelmed by a decision I had to make. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to make this. And I just sat with it alone at this desk for a long time, being like, this is terrible. And then I went to bed, woke up the next morning. I was like, oh no, I just need to call Kelly on my team. And it was a 5-minute conversation. Decision was clear. And not only was the decision clear, but she asked a question that let me build on the decision. So then not only were we resolving this one problem, but we created the next step. Right. It was a 5-minute generative conversation. 12 hours previously, I was like, this is going to bury me. There's no way I can do it.
All of this sounds wonderful. It sounds fantastic. I'm working in this environment. I'm collaborating with like-minded professionals. We're just spewing ideas back and forth. This sounds fantastic and nothing at all like the reality that I live in right. whatsoever. I'm guessing you probably know a thing or two about that alternate reality. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And the alternate reality is, but I'm going to be clear, most work relationships are neutral and positive. However, there are those relationships that drag us down, that are incredibly challenging, that take up an outsized portion of our mental energy, our emotional energy. And that's when you think about collaborating. Most people, if you ask them, I mean, I think most people are like you and me. You say, oh, you're going to collaborate with people. You're like, oh gosh, they're going to be slow. They're going to have stupid ideas, right? Like, our immediate instinct isn't like, yes, I bet we'll all get along like perfectly. We're going to anticipate some bumps. And that's smart, because you will have bumps. Human interaction is messy. And so you have to embrace that alternate reality, which is, this isn't going to be pretty, and it might even be painful at times. I might even have to pull the plug. And I'm sure we could all name a few projects where the relationships and the inability to get along killed that project, right? So there's the risk of having all of that happen, but there's also the joy or the upside of being able to navigate that in a way that you do produce something better. And even if you don't, you learn so much about yourself in the process that the next project you get on, it's going to go so much better, right? I'm really good at dealing with passive aggressive people because I've dealt with so many of them, right? And that sometimes the instinct is to say, I dealt with a passive aggressive person on this project. It was terrible. Everything went wrong. I'm never working with anyone like that again. But I think what we have to think is, no, how do I build the interpersonal resilience? Because passive aggressive people are all over the place. I am one of them. None of us is above behaving that way, right? So you have to figure out, how do I feel less stress in the moment when I'm interacting with this person? And how do I feel more confident when someone just like them comes back on my next project and I have to deal with them again?
It's funny, amongst all of the things that you mentioned, the first image that came to my mind was my daughter, who's now almost 12. She's in sixth grade. I can picture her coming home a week or two ago. She was so upset. She was so frustrated. I said, what's wrong? She's like, I have to do a group project and I have to do it with other people. I'm like, oh my God, you are so my daughter. Because that's, I literally remember when I was in fourth grade, my parents doing a parent-teacher conference because I refused to work in groups. That's how myopically focused I was. And I just want to do my own thing and my own ideas. I'm like, oh crap, I passed this along to my daughter. But the lesson that I've learned, and I'm trying to impart it on her, is that there's so much value in sharing these ideas with others. But like you alluded to, there's going to be a lot of conflict along the way. And the easiest thing to do, it's not the best thing, but the easiest is I don't want to deal with any of you. I'm just going to do my own thing. And I've gone that direction more than once. Mm-hmm. But again, it yields a much worse product. At least at the time I was at the pinnacle of my career working on something that was probably one of the most creatively fulfilling jobs I've ever had. And I was absolutely miserable and I hated my job and every second of the day and I was burned out. And I just wish that at the time somebody had said to me, maybe it's not the work, maybe it's the people.
That's right.
And once I realized that, I thought it doesn't matter how successful this project is. It doesn't matter how much I enjoy the day-to-day of my process. I just can't work with these people because they're literally killing me. Mm-hmm. And that's when I made the transition from, and this is a very hard transition to make in Hollywood, from it's all about the credits and it's all about the name above the billboard and it's all about the paycheck to it's about the people I'm working with day-to-day. I really learned that lesson and it's made a huge difference in my career.
Yeah. And I occasionally get asked, I love that story. First of all, about your daughter. Yeah, I totally relate. When I got a group project when I was her age, is how do I get them to do nothing so I can just do it all?
Right? Me too.
Yes, right. Which is terrible. It's terrible. But I also like this idea of the relationships, like choosing. I occasionally get asked for career advice, you know, from younger people. And I always say, follow the relationship. If you enjoy working with that person, if you have a good rapport, you don't have to be exactly like, you don't have to agree on everything. You don't have to see eye to eye on everything, but follow the relationships. You want to be able to work with people well. And as you said, it was literally killing you. There are so many stats about the rudeness, the incivility, toxic behavior, that the impact on our physical well-being. And there's another amazing piece of research that was done actually in couples, married couples, where they made a small cut on their skin and then monitored how long it took to heal. And couples who reported having animosity in their relationship, the healing time was like 7 times slower. I mean, that's not the exact number, but that's how I remember it. I can't remember the exact number. But the point being, our bodies aren't healing themselves as fast when we are in relationships marked by animosity. So by all means, we want to choose to work with people we want to work with. Now, that's not always possible either, right? We don't get to choose who we get to work with. People get staffed on a certain project. We just show up and this is who the editor is. This is who the director is, right? You just have to deal. And that's where the skills in my book come in really handy, is that because you're going to have those difficult relationships. There are going to be people who push your buttons. And yes, occasionally the right thing will be to pull the plug, to get off the project, especially if there's physical effects of the stress of those interactions. But more often than not, you're going to have to figure out, how do I nudge this person into a more productive interaction with me? How do I feel less stress when I'm in it? And how do I sort of set the boundaries so that it's not having that truly negative impact on me and my body?
Yeah. And I want to get into the meat of all of that very, very shortly. There's one other thing that I want to cover that I think is really important. Two things, actually. One of which, you said you can't choose who you work with. I agree to an extent, but I disagree to an extent. One of the reasons that essentially what went from kind of a side conversation I'd have with a few clients has become the foundation of my entire business is how to reach out to people and build relationships cold, like how to build your dream mm-hmm. network. And people thought, why are you teaching outreach emails? And like, because it gives you more control to be able to build positive relationships around you with like-minded people that want to solve similar problems and have a deeper why for the impact that their work creates, rather than, well, I got hired on this project and I work with who I work with. I think we have some control. We don't have total control, but I want people to feel like they have a little bit of control over who they get to choose to work with.
Yes. And so, I think you're really smart to point that out. And I think that that's sort of an elite level of career. People should aspire to be able to do that, right? To be able to create their own opportunities. Most of the people I talk with don't feel like that yet. And I think you're absolutely right to help them build the skills to do that, because it's so critical.
So now I want to add on to that before we get into all the details. And as I've mentioned to many of my guests, we'll probably hit about 5% of my notes by the time we're done in the next hour, because there's just so much good stuff to cover, which thankfully you've got a 270-page book to answer many of these questions. But the one other thing that I want to answer might be a potential objection to why do I even need to figure this out? And it's because I kind of do my own thing at work. I don't really like anybody, but I've got a good social network outside of my work. I've got hobbies and I've got friends and I've got buddies. So isn't that enough? Why do I need to worry about having work friends too? Because the last thing I need is more friends.
Yeah, been there. That was me for my entire 20s. Like I was like, colleagues, whatever, colleagues, that's who you are. I think the shortest answer is you're going to have relationships with those people. And I'm not telling you, you have to have friendships with them. Like this is not going out for drinks, getting together on the weekend. You're going to have a relationship with them. You're going to have to interact with them. It is so much better if that relationship is positive. And by no means do you have to buddy up with the people you work with, but you do have to navigate interactions, whether that's over email, instant message, in person, in meetings, on site. Like you're going to have relationships with them, whether you choose to or not. So why not make them as pleasant and as productive as possible?
Yeah, I love that you said that you don't need friendships, but you need relationships. There's no way to avoid it. I only wish that you and I had talked like, I don't know, about 20 years ago. You would have saved me a decade of stress and burnout and anxiety. Like if I just figured this out so much earlier, but that's why we're here, to be able to share this.
That's right.
So now we're going to assume that at least as of now, we've overcome the barrier of why should I even bother worrying about relationships? Just let me do my own thing. Because I've learned, you've talked about, you've got the research to prove you're going to be better at your job and be more creative and productive if you prioritize relationships. Done. Taken care of.
Check.
Now, all of a sudden, I live in this world called reality where not all the relationships are smooth. And what I love about your book is that it's a combination of high-level ideas and concepts to prove a theory, but then it's not just a book, it's a handbook. It's, oh, crap, I've got this passive-aggressive comment. Let me go to page 178. What should I say to them right now, right? So it's really, really practical, and it's so in-depth that it's not just one of these, you read it, and oh, I get the ideas, let me move on to the next book. This to me is kind of one of those, like, all right, I need this next to wherever the window is that has Slack open right now. Mm-hmm. So then in the instant, I can go to this page and figure out how do I respond to this. So I say that because I really think this is a great handbook, guidebook for somebody to kind of have next to them if they're struggling with relationships. We cannot cover all of it, but I think at least the place to start is very briefly discussing your 8 archetypes. Mm-hmm. And then there's 3 that I want to zoom into a little bit further because I think they're the most relevant for both my world and the world that a lot of my audience lives in. Yeah. So talk to me about how you organize this on a very practical level amongst these different archetypes and conflicts.
Yeah. So 8 archetypes, these are not mutually exclusive, meaning people can fit into multiple of them and they're not exhaustive. I'm sure there are lots of people who wouldn't fit into any of these categories. I organized it this way because I knew there was research and advice that's applicable to these patterns of behavior. And I wanted people to get that specific advice to deal with their situation. You know, I'm not happy unless someone puts this book down and says, I can do this right now, which is why you really made me very happy with pinpointing that exact piece, right? Like, I love the theory. I love the research, but I also want to give people tools. So the 8 archetypes are insecure manager, pessimist, victim, passive aggressive, I'm going out of order here, but biased colleague, political operator, the tormentor, so that's someone who you expect to be a mentor, but actually torments you instead. And then I'm forgetting, the know-it-all. Of course, I always forget the know-it-all because that's me, but we can get to that.
The 3 that I resonated with the most as far as if I could just walk away tomorrow and better manage the people that I've worked with, these are the 3 that I would want to dig into. But the other thing that I want to get to a little bit later, but I think we can also weave in here as well, is sometimes it's not always about them and it's about you. And guess what? Whoever's listening this trying to figure out how to resolve conflict, you're probably one, if not more, of the archetypes. And they're thinking the same things about you that you're thinking about them. So I think it's really important that we put ourselves on the hot seat before the end of today's session. Yes. To really understand that sometimes I'm the one. And on the other end of the Slack call, they're the one that's reading Amy's book, trying to figure out how to deal with me. Having that level of awareness, I've learned, even though it can be painful and really uncomfortable sometimes, I found that better understanding me and my tendencies helps me better manage relationships because I can step outside myself. So I just want to set the table that this is not about all how you deal with difficult people and you're perfect. It's you're one of those difficult people.
Yeah.
So
well, can I tell you?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I just want to tell you a funny story. This literally happened like 3 hours ago. So several months ago, a colleague reached out and said, I need help dealing with this person. They're being a total know-it-all. They're being a jerk. And I said, okay, gave them my best advice. This happens a lot as someone writes books like I do. So I gave her my best advice. I got a call today from someone who said, I need help dealing with someone who is a complete know-it-all and being really rude to me. And it was the original person who had reached out to me, who is now, and I was like, we are in like a leapfrog of know-it-alls. Like this is, and I think that's the perfect, I think this person would be horrified to know that they had behaved in the way that they had suffered from, you know, months earlier. But that's exactly it. We're none of us is beyond this behavior. And I think it's really important to embrace that.
My sincerest apologies for the interruption, but if you're a creative professional who spends long hours at your workstation, not only is the following promo not an interruption, but listening has the potential to change your life. Because working with a topo mat underneath you at a height-adjustable workstation is a game changer. Let's learn a little bit more from ErgoDriven co-founder and CEO Kit Perkins, creator of the topo mat.
The topo mat is the first anti-fatigue mat designed specifically for standing desks. The real benefit of a standing desk is movement. We found bringing in this cushioned terrain under your feet, your brain just subconsciously engages and you wander around and you get that movement at the standing desk that you need without even having to think about it at all.
People will come to me at an event or a panel and they'll say, I got the topo mat because of you. Even when they had a mat, once they used this one, it was a total game changer.
We've just heard time and time again that with topo, we've kind of hit the sweet spot that it's the right premium quality materials and a right shape that people are actually getting benefit out of this stuff.
You spend more time here than anywhere if you do creative work the way that I do. So I would rather be driving around in a Ferrari than a Ford Pinto. And I feel like this is the Ferrari of the standing mat.
One of the things you don't realize is that at a standing desk, your main interface to the world, your body's main interface to the world is the ground. If you're going to invest in anything at that Ferrari level, it should be what you're standing on.
Well, my goal is that for anybody that is a creative professional like myself that's stuck in front of a computer for inordinate amounts of time of their waking life, they're doing it standing on a topo mat. So you and I, my friend, one edit station at a time are going to change the world.
I like it. That's a utopian vision I can get on board with.
If you're a creative professional looking for a simple and affordable way to stay active, energetic, and focused while spending long hours at your height adjustable workstation, I can't stress enough how important it is to have the right mat underneath you, which is why I continue to share the topo mat as my number one product recommendation. To learn more about the topo mat and purchase yours, visit optimizeyourself.me/topo. That's T-O-P-O.
Yeah, and the other thing that I want to add too, which is a totally different tangent for a different podcast with a different book, but I think if we really get into the deepest levels of psychology and human interaction, quite often the traits in others that bother you the most are because they're just like you. And there's more than one time I've gotten so frustrated with a colleague. I'm like, it's because they're just like me. Damn it. Right. So I think that for me is one of the biggest triggers is when I realize this is making me so mad because that's exactly what I would do in this situation.
That's right.
Right. So having said that, the three that I think, and there might be audiences or people in the audience that are listening saying, yeah, but what about this or what about this? But if I'm going to do my best to speak for the creatives in the small dark room, the three that resonated with me the most, and I have a feeling my podcast producer is going to frantically say, no, but what about these? But for me, it's not even the insecure boss, just the insecure team members and collaborators. It would be the passive aggressive person, and it would be the TOR mentor. And I want to frame why, and then I want to dig into each one.
Sure.
So I have this hypothesis, and it's not based on a tremendous amount of research, at least not quite yet. But I believe that the epicenter of the universe of insecure creative people that just want to be seen and heard, they all move to Hollywood, California.
Or Washington, D.C., maybe.
But Washington, D.C., or, you know, New York. But I think that when it comes specifically to storytellers that really want their voices heard, they want their ideas out there, they want to tell their stories, and they're doing it because there's a high level of insecurity, this is the epicenter of the universe for them. Hmm. Mm-hmm. And over and over and over, I feel that so many of the conflicts that I deal with are just because I'm dealing with people that are overexerting their insecurity with overconfidence or just being downright mean or rude. Mm-hmm. So let's start with the insecure people that we're working with to better understand how can we understand where they're coming from and how can we better manage conflicts driven by insecurity.
Yeah. I've had people tell me, I like working with people. I just don't like working with their egos. Right. And I think that's exactly where the insecurity comes in. So in each chapter, I really try to break down, why would someone behave like this? What's the rational explanation? Just to give you a little bit of insight, hopefully a little bit of empathy, also maybe a little bit of recognition. Maybe I also behave that way because I agree with your point. The things that bother us are the things that are in other people are things that we have ourselves. And then I talk about tactics and sample language you can use. So let's talk about insecurity. Why does it happen? It happens because it is a normal human trait, right? There is a very descriptive label for people who have no insecurity, and that is psychopaths, right? They have no self-doubt, 100% confident. Having that insecurity is normal. The problem is when they take it out on you. So it becomes uncontained, right? And then they start taking it out on you by micromanaging, over-criticizing, maybe gatekeeping resources. That's a big one, right? To make themselves look more powerful. All of those behaviors are sort of trying to cover up the sense that they don't feel like they're enough. And I think even just knowing that and reminding yourself that this micromanager or this person who's sort of constantly like puffing themselves up so they look bigger than others, they're basically a child that is trying to feel okay. And I think sometimes that alone softens my stance toward them. The challenge is, though, and I will actually, your comment about Hollywood is not surprising, partly because the other thing you would think is the more senior or more powerful someone gets, the less insecure they feel. But research has shown the opposite, right?
Polar opposite. Oh my God.
That's
the
right.
Worst insecurity I've ever dealt with were the people at the very highest levels.
And there's a reason for that, because the expectations for their performance are so much higher. So that gap between how competent they feel and how competent people expect them to be, there's a perception there that creates a perception gap that creates a huge amount of insecurity for them. And you look at, you know, there's a couple of surveys I've done of CEOs. Sometimes the biggest thing that keeps them up at night is the fear of being found out to be a fraud, right? Like, and it's, you're like, you're a CEO. What's going on? Like, you have the money, you have the authority, you have the title. What is happening? But that's the reality. So what do you do with it? Now, I have to say, the advice that the research points to for this particular archetype is my least favorite, because I don't like to tell people to do it, but we know it works. And that first and foremost is about calming that ego, which is about flattery, right? It's genuine flattery. Because they're up there going, I'm good, right? I'm good, right? I'm good, right? And the more you're like, yep, you're good, the more they're going to put sort of soften that ego a little bit and let you in and let you then collaborate with them. It is the last thing I want to do when I'm dealing with someone who's insecure of like, you're so good at this. Well, like, it just feels gross and unctuous. But we do know it works, and it has to be genuine, right? If someone is terribly indecisive, don't compliment them on their decision-making skills, right? Like, find something. Did they work on a project that you really admired? Did they make a decision about something that you actually thought was brave, but other people didn't? And you want to comment on that, right? Anything you can just sort of show them that you actually believe they're good at their job will help to sort of calm that ego. You mentioned your daughter, but my daughter, who's now a teenager, came home when she was younger. She had this issue with this kid at school. She was about 8 years old, and it was always, we called it the Natalie report. Like, every night there was something about how terrible Natalie was at recess. And one night we were like, what's the Natalie report? And she said, no report. We said, why? And she said, because when we got on the playground, I just said, Natalie, I like your shirt. And then we played and it was totally fine. And I was like, oh my gosh, she has figured out like what decades of research has shown about dealing with insecure people, of just a well-placed compliment can sometimes just sort of take the tension out. Now, of course, you're not just going to sit there and flatter them. Another tactic you can use is to actually change the power dynamic, right? So especially if this is someone who's more powerful than you, a boss or perhaps more senior on this project you're working on together, this project you're working on together, is that you want to show them you have something that's valuable to them, a source of knowledge, a special skill set, a prior experience, not in any threatening way, but in a way that's sort of, listen, I have this, I can give it to you. I can bring this to the project. That sort of takes a little bit of the power dynamic of them feeling like they need to micromanage or they can't trust you. Like that alters that a little bit. So that's another tactic. Now, just reality check. Does any of this seem like it would be helpful when you're thinking about the insecure people that you work with?
Oh my God, the amount of flashbacks that I've had in the last 5 minutes, I almost can't even recall all of them. But the first thing I want to share is that, and I really hope that this girl's parents don't listen to my podcast. They don't, they do. We literally right now on a daily basis have the Abby report.
Oh my God.
Just had this conversation yesterday. What happened with Abby yesterday? How did this go? Like, because my daughter's former best friend, now these two are just constantly going at it.
Yeah.
And I'm already thinking I know exactly what to tell her to do tomorrow. Yeah. Because I've really probably to my own detriment, and I shouldn't have, because I'm of these eight archetypes, I too am the know-it-all. And I've had to spend my entire life trying to be more compassionate about realizing that other people may not be coming to the same conclusions that I am quite as quickly. But I've really psychoanalyzed why she's having this issue, because I talk to my daughter like she's 25, not like she's 11. We have adult conversations. And I said, listen, this is because she's really insecure. She's just really insecure and she wants people to like her and she's lashing out and she's saying all these mean things because she wants attention. That's not about you. It's about her. What I didn't provide her was a solution. Now I have a solution. So this is really, really helpful. But for those that are not dealing with middle school girls and all their antics, I had several flashbacks, but one thing that I've used often when I feel like I'm fighting with an ego rather than with an idea, and I want to talk more about the idea of collaboration and fighting with ideas, but I'm not going to say the name, but I've worked with one of the biggest, most difficult egos in the industry. Anybody wants to go on IMDb Pro, they're going to be like, nah, it's probably this person, but I'm not going to say their name. But what I learned worked really well with this person, and I didn't have this framework, but I was doing the same thing, is that I could tell they were very, very insecure. And every time I gave a thought or an idea, I was attacking their identity.
Yes.
And I realized that if I framed it as like, listen, this, you're the best at this. This is amazing. It doesn't change the fact that the scene isn't working right now. It doesn't change the fact that I think we can do better with this transition. By framing it that way, it went from, oh, I hate working with this person, to, oh, you're right, that's a really good idea. Let's work on that. Because it wasn't about the attack on their identity. It was attacking this one little idea. So I've used this before very, very successfully.
Yeah. And you want to affirm, I think about this with difficult conversations a lot, right? You want to affirm the relationship, right? I love working with you. Again, if it's true, right? I really learn from you every time we work together. It's something that sort of, again, dampen, like sort of takes down that ego, what we call ego sensitivity, and then actually then introduce the new idea or the conflict or the disagreement and saying, the one thing I think we need to do though here is this, right? And you're using a tactic that's been really proven to work, not just in your experience, but in research as well.
So I want to get into the other ones, but is going to be a little bit of a tangent, not tangent. I want to dig deeper into this idea of the best idea wins and attacking ideas, not attacking egos, because I've spent half of my career, as I mentioned earlier, chasing the credits and the prestige and the name on the top of the movie poster. And I've spent the second half of my career building relationships with people that just also so happen to be very successful and have great shows. But for me, the choice is first, great people. And secondly, is this a great show and it's successful? Terrific. But that to me is a side effect. It's not what I'm chasing. And one of the biggest, and I don't ask this question outright when I'm going to interview people, and I want to actually have you help me workshop how I can figure out the environment I would be going into. The most important thing for me is that I work with people where the best idea wins. Mm-hmm. Is by far the most important working environment I want to be in. And I have had crazy heated arguments about, well, we should do this or that, or these scenes should be in this order. What about this or that? But then as soon as you figure it out, you're like, cool, that was fun. Let's go have drinks.
Yes.
As opposed to, you're an idiot or you can't write, or like, I hate those environments and I've been in those. So I want to help people better understand how, with the limited amount of control we have, we make sure we're entering environments where the best creative ideas win, and there can still be conflicts and arguments and disagreements, but it's about the idea and not about the ego. How do we make sure we can build that world around us?
Yeah. So you're talking about something that Linda Hill, who's a professor at Harvard Business School, who studies creativity a lot, calls creative friction, right? You want that friction around ideas. You want to say, nope, that scene's not going to work. Nope, we need to change the script this way, right? You want to be able to do that all the time without anyone going, but that was my idea, or like, no, or the worst is someone who defends something to the death where you know they don't actually believe that's the best idea, but it's theirs, right? And so they have, or even worse is if they're defending it because it's the most powerful person in the room's idea, right? And then they're just the sycophant. Anyway, to get to that environment, there's a couple things you can do. One is just normalize disagreement, right? Right from the beginning, say, we're not always going to see eye to eye. That's a good thing. I like that tension. I want that tension. We should really lean into that tension, because this is about us creating whatever it is, this show, this episode, right? And really trying to emphasize both the shared goal. So you're putting yourselves metaphorically all on the same side of the table, as opposed to this tug of war of whose idea is going to win, right? So emphasizing the shared goal, normalizing disagreement right from the beginning. And then I think even asking people, if you have the opportunity to sort of suss people out before you start working with them, like, how did you handle disagreements on that project, right? What was the biggest fight over? How did it get resolved? Like, just trying to get a sense of how do people think about these points of conflict. Some people are really good at telling a great story around that, but you'll get a sense. There might be some red flags that come up, or you might get some green flags of, oh, they're going to be able to do this. And even saying things like, I like to work in an environment where we talk about ideas, not egos. Like, people often say things they want without actually, and then they were like, I don't know why I can't find that. I'm like, well, did you say it? Like, did you actually voice it? I work with leaders all the time who say, I want someone to disagree with me. I'm like, did you tell them that? Like, did you tell them 5 times? Because that's how many times you got to tell them before they're willing to do it. So I think that's the other thing, is just saying, this is the kind of environment I want here.
Yeah, I love that you just brought up the idea of, from the other perspective, not I want to work with people, but I want to build a team. I literally just had this conversation on Monday where I was trying to figure out how to realign one of my team members' roles, because they're trying to figure out where they fit in, where they don't fit in. And we talked about some of the specifics in the day-to-day. And I said to them, the most important reason that I need you on this team is you constantly disagree with me. You always challenge my ideas. And I want that. That's really important. I want you to challenge my thoughts, but you do it in a respectful way where you and I disagree on the approach or the idea, but I never feel threatened. I never feel like you're doing it because you're trying to posture. It's just, you think your idea is better than mine. And more than half the time, you're right. I need that on my team.
Yes. And that's, if I could give one piece of advice to senior people, no matter what industry they're in, tell a story often of a time where someone disagreed with you and it helped. Because the more senior we get in organization, more power, the less likely you are to be disagreed with. We know that from research, right? People are not going to give you input. They're not going to give you honest feedback. They're going to sugarcoat everything. If you want the true feedback, tell a story exactly like you just did of a time someone disagreed with you and it was helpful, and how you rewarded them as a result. Because countering someone's perspective, especially someone in power, is intimidating. Our natural instinct is not to challenge someone and disagree. It's to get along. It's to be likable. So the more you give people permission and lay out and illustrate the rewards they'll get for taking that risk, the more likely it'll come to you.
Yeah. And without getting too much context, I want people to understand how valuable this was for me, and it can be for others. If you're thinking, well, I always disagree with somebody, but I never want to say anything. This wasn't just, I have an idea for a project, or it should be this font choice or whatever. It was literally the kernel foundation of the idea that led to the business that I'm building and the business that I was going to expand. It was literally the kernel of, this is what I want to build. And he said, yeah, but what if it wasn't that? What if you did something totally different? And at the time, I was like, F you. This where it started 7 years ago. How dare you? And then I went home. I'm like, damn it. He's right. Shit. right? Yeah. And now I've gone in a completely different direction because I was working under a false assumption for so many years. Yeah. I needed that. That was so valuable to me.
Yeah.
So I want people that are questioning, well, should I even engage with somebody that's insecure or question their ideas? A lot of times they're actually seeking that and it's valuable when, again, it's about the idea and it's not about the ego. And I want to move on to, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I just want to point out what your team member did was so smart, which is like the what if question, right? You don't have to say, I think you're wrong. This isn't going to work. Let me point out all the risks. What if the assumptions we made aren't true? What if we looked at this differently? What if the audience hates it? Like just anything to ask the question, the what if question is a great way to introduce that friction without having to attack someone's ego.
Yeah, it's a million and a half flashbacks to my past. This is going to be a little bit more of an anecdote, but I worked on a TV series for years that was called Burn Notice. Mm-hmm. That was about a spy that was formerly in the CIA. And when you get fired, it's called your burn. And they basically blacklist you and they try to kill you. It was this long running series. And sometimes we would get these just most ridiculously ignorant notes from people that you would think are like executives in some tower that haven't even seen the show. And the joke was always, well, what are the notes today? And I said, the note is, well, what if he wasn't a spy? It's like, that's the whole show, right? But those are the kind of notes. It's like, it's a little late for that note. So I want to go to at least these other two, if not more. Yeah. But I got to ask as a side note, what in the world does a furry squirrel have to do with any of this conversation?
Oh, gosh. This was a piece of advice from a Michigan professor who's amazing. And she, you know, I asked her,
Go Blue, by the way, who's the Michigan professor.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You're putting me on the spot and I'm so terrible recalling names. It'll come to me.
The same. Don't worry.
Yes. She's great. It's going to come to me. I was interviewing her for the Insecure chapter and she was talking about, someone senior in her organization who, was, you know, basically really intimidated by her. And she was working with a coach to help sort of navigate this relationship because it was a critical relationship in her work. And she was finding it so frustrating. And her coach said, just before you go into the meeting with them, just imagine yourself as a fluffy little squirrel. And she said, it's the most ridiculous mental exercise, but it helped me just sort of soften my edges a little bit. And it totally changed the tenor of our interactions. And she's like, I wasn't actually doing anything differently, but I just think I was just a little bit softer in a way that didn't threaten them. I don't love giving the advice of like, diminish yourself. Like, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying change, because we often go into these interactions, especially with someone who's insecure, where it feels like a battle. And if you go in thinking this is a battle, they're going to feel that, right? But if you go in and like, I'm a cute little fluffy squirrel, like you're just going to be a little bit softer, a little bit more open. It's going to make the collaboration a little bit easier.
So it's basically the same concept as like Amy Cuddy's like, I'm going to stand here in my power pose, but instead before the meeting, I'm going to do this instead. Yeah.
Maybe have a few nuts before you go in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Lindy Greer, your podcast producer, just put it in the comments. Thank you so much. Lindy is amazing.
All right. So the next one I want to go to, I mean, like, you know, if you want to, it's fine. You know, I mean, I guess, I don't know. Passive aggressive. Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about something else, it's cool. But
yeah, it's up to you.
Passive aggressiveness. I guess we should talk about passive aggressiveness.
Yeah, I mean, it's up to you. If you don't want to do it, it's totally fine. Totally fine.
You tell me. I mean, whatever you want. It's good.
Oh man, this is a good one. This was the first chapter I ever wrote for the book. It was actually in the book proposal because I get asked. I can tell whenever I give a talk or workshop, you know, about conflict, difficult conversations, whatever, I can count. It's going to be the first, second, or third question in the Q&A. How do I deal with someone who's passive aggressive, right? And we don't even have to like define it. We just acted it out a bit, but we don't even have to define. I mean, it's the person who says one thing, does another, tells you they're fine when they're really upset about something. They basically don't feel comfortable for some reason exhibiting their or sort of conveying their thoughts and feelings in a direct manner. So they do it in an indirect manner. And then when you try to sort of pinpoint what they're thinking or feeling, it becomes shadow boxing. And they're like, no, all good. No, I didn't say that. No, I didn't mean that. And it's interesting, the origin, the passive aggressive term was first used in the US military in the, I think it was the First World War, to describe soldiers who were non-compliant with their officers' directives. It then went through a whole host of, you know, different psychological diagnoses. It was part of the DSM. It wasn't. It's just a very common behavior. And the reason that we all behave passive aggressively is because of a fear of something, right? Fear of conflict, fear of rejection, perhaps because of some anxiety that, they might feel. Or honestly, oftentimes people are trained to use this way of communicating. They see other people do it and it works well for them. It's often, we often see people who don't have traditional access to power, who therefore are not expected to be assertive or direct. They'll often use this as an effective way to get their ideas across. We can debate whether it's actually effective, but usually, think about the last passive-aggressive person you interacted with. You knew exactly what they felt. They just weren't saying it, right? And that's the key when you get to sort of tactics. One of well, first of all, never call them passive-aggressive, because no one comes home from work and was like, I was so passive-aggressive today, right? They might say they were petty. They might say the other person was too assertive, like who knows, or they might even admit they're conflict averse, but no one thinks they're passive aggressive and that's just going to upset them. But what you can also do is focus on what's the underlying message. Like what, right? Like if I were to just take our silly interaction right there, I'd say, well, Zach doesn't really want to talk about passive aggressive, you know? And so I can say, now I have a choice. I can either just continue because Zach didn't say it directly, or I can hypothesis test and say, Are you sure you want to talk about this? I get the sense maybe this isn't the best topic. We could do this instead, right? So then they might say, because they're passive aggressive, no, it's fine. Let's go. But you now put them on notice that I'm not just taking what you say at face value. I'm also paying attention to your body language, the tone of delivery. And it might hopefully ease them a little bit into trying out to be more direct with you. I have a friend who's incredibly passive aggressive. And if I say, do you want to have dinner at 8 o'clock on Friday? She'll say, you know, yes. But I have to be here at this time and I have to, and I'm like, okay, are you sure you want, no, I want to have dinner, but you know, and it's like, I'm not sure what's actually happening here. And so I've started, what I'll do is I'll text her and I'll say, you know, do you want to have dinner on Friday? Just write A for yes. And B for no, right? I've removed the need for her to actually explain to me why or why not or what, you know? And I think sometimes you just want to sort of pave the way for these people to be a little more direct. It's a lot of work on your part, but I think a lot of times what they actually think and feel is very valuable information or crucial information. So the more you can reduce the hurdle for them to have to be direct, the more you can make smooth the way, you're going to get that input.
I feel like this is the absolute perfect place to insert the following quote from The Notebook. What do you want? What do you want? Right? Because you're just like, could you just tell me what you're feeling or what you need from me instead of going around it?
Yes.
So I love the idea of breaking it down from a big decision into little micro decisions. This might be a little bit of a tangent and maybe it won't be, but one of the things I just realized, and I don't know if you talk about this too deeply in the book, but I just had the realization that in different contexts, I'm more dominant with one of these than the other. Mm-hmm. In a professional context, I feel like the one I have to be the most careful of is the know-it-all. Yeah. In personal and relationship conflicts, I'm totally the passive-aggressive one because I'm like, no, I'm fine. I'm not upset. And I know where I get this from because my entire family is the same way. And I'm very much the person who's like, no, I'm fine. Boom. Yeah. All of it comes out. So is it common that you find that people in different contexts have different kind of default tendencies?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, it's partly because of our expectations, like what's professional, or what's the norm in this group, right? Our family is a great example of like, we have norms about how we behave and those norms are deeply ingrained in us, but that doesn't mean we're going to necessarily apply them to another context. You know, I think we're probably... if we were to choose 2-3 archetypes that we fall into most often, chances are there's probably shades of those everywhere. But oftentimes they're sort of socialized out of us, right? I was very passive aggressive earlier in my career, and then I realized it was getting me nowhere, right? And the more I saw senior people, people I admired, not behaving that way and being very direct and assertive, I was like, oh, wait, this is what's going to get me success, right? So you can have these things socialized out of you. You know, I think the thing about families that are really interesting, my sister-in-law, when she first married my husband, at her first Christmas with us, was horrified because I opened a gift from my mom and said, oh, this is nice, I'm going to return it. And she was like, what? Because in her family, you said, thank you, you loved it, you put it on display when they showed up. And in our family, we were just sort of like, yeah, it's not quite right, I'm going to get a different color. And it to her, that sort of directness was so uncomfortable. And you have to remember, that's not because her family was wrong or because they were passive aggressive. Like, we just have to remember, people have different tolerances for assertiveness and directness. And there's no judgment on that. It's just the tolerance that they've got.
I have spent almost 10 years now raving about how much I love my Topomat. And I have finally discovered what I now consider the Topomat of desk chairs, the Core 360. The Core 360, spelled Q-O-R, is designed to keep me constantly moving while seated in an upright and balanced position. To learn more about how it works, let's hear from Core 360 founder, Dr. Turner Osler, about why he created the Core 360 active sitting chair.
When you sit badly for many hours a day, and that's really what the problem is. It's very hard to make yourself get up and do jumping jacks every half hour. But if you just swap to a chair that requires you to be muscularly engaged in order not to fall off, it's an easy bar to clear.
For the procrastinators out there who hear all of the statistics and know how bad sitting is and it's the new smoking, and they're thinking, that's something I'll worry about in a few decades, you're gonna feel the effects of having more energy at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 4 o'clock in the afternoon that day.
And that's the whole point. Your core muscles will be stronger, you'll have less back pain. All of this will make you more available for the rest of the pursuits of your life, your kids, your hobbies, your whatever.
For those of us who need to practically live in front of computers to do our best creative work, the Core 360 is going to level up your game. Keep your body moving and keep the creativity flowing. To learn more and purchase what I consider to be the Topomat of desk chairs, please go to optimizeyourself.me/core360. That's optimizeyourself.me/QOR360.
And this brings up another topic that I wanted to hopefully get into, and I think this is the perfect place to insert it. There was a phrase that you had that to me could literally be an entire book or a book series, which was that people treat you according to the boundaries that you set. And it seems to me that passive aggressive behavior could largely come from people that are too afraid to set those boundaries and assert those boundaries. So let's talk a little bit more about boundaries, or lack thereof, often leads to passive aggressive behavior.
Yeah. I mean, I think if someone behaves passive aggressively and then you reward them for that, right? And you sort of don't allow, you don't set the boundary of like, I'm confused, what exactly do you want? Right. They're just going to continue to do that behavior. And I think this is such a critical point of the book, and it's so basic, but I think we all forget it, is you cannot change another person. I am not going to hammer the passive aggressiveness out of my colleague. But what I can say is, or what I can demonstrate is, until I get a direct answer, or until I can, you know, sort of set up a framework in which you can be a little more straightforward, this is not going to move forward. And that doesn't mean you have to say the project stopped until you figure this out. You have to figure out what is appropriate for you, what is tolerable for you in terms of this sort of level of directness, or the level of, maybe it's passive aggressive or know it all. Like, we all have different tolerances for that. And then you have to educate people in your interactions about how to do that. Because people, and I don't think it's intentional, I don't think people are trying to take advantage. I think they're just trying to succeed. They're trying to interact, and they're going to do that at the place they feel comfortable with. Unless you shift those bounds a little bit, you're going to just be dealing with what they give you. I don't know if that's what you were sort of alluding to with the boundaries, but that's sort of how I think of it, is that you really have to educate people about what your tolerances are.
I do agree with that. And what I want to actually even take this a layer deeper, which is another area that I know you spend a lot of time researching that you talk about some in the book, but in a lot of your other work, is that I brought up this idea of passive aggressiveness, specifically asserting boundaries. Because my guess is when it comes to managing passive aggressive behavior, there's a big difference in women versus men. Mm. Talk to me more about how just conditioning and gender expectations really factors into these kind of conflicts.
Yeah, there is a whole, and this was something that was really important to me in the book, is to really, because I think a lot of the advice about dealing with difficult conversations, dealing with difficult people, default to a certain style, which is often associated with men. And I think I really wanted to pay attention to issues of identity in the book, because what works for one person may not work for another, depending on their identity. There is tons and tons of research that shows that we expect women to be collaborative, to care about the collective, to even be demure, right? To not be what we call in the literature agentic, which is to be assertive. And when they do, we tend to penalize them. The sort of one of the most sort of vivid examples of this is research where they had women negotiate their salaries compared with men negotiating their salaries. Then they asked the people who were on the receiving end of the negotiation how likely they were to want to work with this person. When men negotiated their salaries, there was no impact. People reported wanting to work with them or not, no differently than if they didn't negotiate. For women, universally, people reported not wanting to work with them, right? They did not like the idea that they were being assertive. And it's incredibly frustrating as a woman to think about that research and think about, well, does that mean I can't be assertive? Obviously not. There are lots of women we can all think of, I'm sure, many examples who are assertive. It just means that we have to balance it with a little bit of warmth, because that sort of shows that we're still adhering to the gender expectation. The classic example that I think this is, I think it's from Lean In, which that's a whole other conversation, but is that, why can I not think of names? Sheryl Sandberg.
Sheryl Sandberg.
Thank you. God, names today are really hard. When she went to negotiate with Mark Zuckerberg about her salary, instead of saying, here's what I deserve, here's the number, here's what I was making, she said, you need me as your COO to be a good negotiator. So I'm going to show you right now how I can negotiate. So I'm going to negotiate my salary. What she did is she gave it this frame of like, I'm not doing this for myself. I'm doing this for the collective. I'm helping you by showing you what a good negotiator I am. Now that's exhausting mental gymnastics to have to do, but it does show that, and truthfully, that would be a good tactic no matter your gender, right? Balancing assertiveness and warmth makes people trust you, gives you status, right? So it's just more imperative given gender stereotypes that women do it.
The next question I'm going to have to table, because I think it would probably, again, take up an entire episode and maybe an entire book series, which is, where did all that conditioning come from? Because my guess is that even if it were me in the experiment negotiating with a man versus a woman, knowing all the things you told me, I bet my default setting subconsciously is to feel exactly the same way.
And
I'm both fascinated and terrified by the fact that that's the world that we've built. So maybe there's like a 1 minute version of that that could become an entire series someday. But what's the 1 minute version of why even somebody who's conscious of it is going to have that same reaction?
Well, because it's in the air. It's like sexism, racism, right? Like all these biases are not just, we like to think that we own them, like I have them or I don't, or right? But they're everywhere, right? They're in the media we consume. They're in the way we treat, people in interactions in a coffee shop. Like it's just everywhere. And so we sort of get steeped in it. And it's going to take a real reckoning to actually address it. And that's why I like to give advice for people who fall into these categories, because I'm not going to tell you to wait around for 150 years while we dismantle the patriarchy. Like you need your money now, right? You need to interact with people now. And so I think we have to think about what are the tactics to deal with the real world. But yes, that is a much longer conversation and fascinating.
Yeah. And there's a joke that I often tell. And for anybody that listened to part one or has heard other shows, they're probably are going to know the joke that's coming. But I feel like it's just the best explanation of both of biases, but a lot of times of our perception of the world. You've got two fish going to work, crossing paths. One says, how's the water today? And the other one says, what's water? Right? Like we say, oh, I don't have biases, but we don't even see them in the world around us. And I'm glad that at least the awareness is developing. But like you said, it's not going to be, you know, 6 months and a couple of workshops and we've rewired all of it. So I like that there's this interim step of how to work with it practically rather than just waiting for everything to change, which is actually a really good segue to the third one that I wanted to talk about, which is the tormentor, right? And the reason that I'm pinpointing this one for this audience is that there's this, and I want to talk more about how not just gender or inequity, but generational gaps factor into these conflicts. Because what I see so much in the entertainment industry is the mentality of it's always been done this way. If you can't handle 16-hour days, this is just how we do it, right? You go get a normal job, go work at a bank, go become an accountant. If you can't handle it, this is how we've always done it. And it's always worked just fine. And I came out just fine. And my response is, clearly you're not fine if you're okay with treating people this way. So talk a little bit more about the tormentor, the people that we expect to be our leaders and lead us into this next generation that instead just want to bludgeon us to the point of like, well, we're going to haze you. This is just the way that it is. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, this isn't made for you.
Yeah. I'm glad you used the word hazing because that's exactly what it is, right? It's like, I went through this. It was hard. You have to prove it that you can be as tough. And I think a lot of times, in fact, I talked to a couple women for this chapter where that explained like the person who was tormenting them was another woman, a senior woman. And they said, I think they're truly trying to toughen me up. Like, I don't think they're trying to say, oh, it has to, you know, you must suffer. I think they're really trying to make sure I have what it takes to succeed. Now, think about it. Like, if you gain power, prestige, money, playing under certain rules, when you got to the top, would you say, we should change the rules, right? No. Changing the rules would mean you maybe don't retain that power. You don't retain that status. So I think that's really what's going on in the mind of the tormentor is these are the rules under which I succeeded. I'm not going to change these rules. And I just have to make sure the people below me can actually win under these rules too. It's a very short-sighted view, right? Like I agree with you. If once you get there, take a look back and go, was that necessary? Like, did I have to suffer in that way? Did I have to do those 16-hour days? And if you can change it, do. And there are lots of people who are, right? A lot of people who are. But that tormentor attitude is oftentimes, I think, well-meaning. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes I think it's an abuse of power. If I got up there, I was mistreated. I'm just going to pay it forward in the worst way possible. So I think that that tormentor attitude can be really, really hard to dismantle. And one of the biggest things is to actually display sympathy for the struggles they did, right? It was even saying things like, wow, like the fact that you made it under those circumstances is impressive. Like, I feel so lucky I'm coming up in a different time, right? Just sort of emphasizing this is not the same as that, right? And asking them questions like, what was the hardest part? How did you actually do that, right? Like, how did you, what skills or traits do you think really helped you actually get to where you are? Because it shows appreciation rather than a resistance, right? I think that's the hard part is they call it the kids these days effect, right? Of like, oh, kids these days don't understand. Kids these days, you know, it's the equivalent of like, I walk to school and back both ways uphill and sleet, you know, and you want to make sure you appreciate that, you show you respect that, but that also it doesn't need to be that way. And I think sometimes there's, you know, a lot of the tactics I share, so range from very direct saying, like, you know, actually having a real conversation and giving people feedback to sort of indirect, right? The pain of the compliment to the insecure person is a little more indirect. I think with the tormentor, sometimes it can be helpful to have the meta conversation, not why are you torturing me? Why are you challenging my work ethic? Why are you giving me unnecessary work? All the things which tormentors do, but saying, I feel like our relationship isn't as strong as I want it to be. What can I do to improve it? Right? Something just sort of having that bigger conversation, or I feel like we didn't quite get off on the right foot on this project. How can we switch things up? How can we make things better? And sometimes you might just get resistance and they'll say, work 16 hours and keep your mouth shut. But you might also get some clues of like how they prefer to be treated. You know, I think you both want to appeal to their empathy, but also set some boundaries. This is the chapter, I will say, where most of the people I interviewed actually quit. And it's not ideal, but I think it is a really hard behavior to change. And this is where the boundaries come into play, right? So much of that behavior is not a reflection of me, it's a reflection of them, right? And really watch yourself around the generational stuff, because I think it's really easy to start with kids these days or old people, or like, you know, there's so many disparaging comments about people from different generations. But the reality is we've all either been there or are going to be there, right? You know, I'm Gen X, and I would love to say millennials are entitled and Gen Z is even more entitled. But the truth is, when I was 25, I was entitled, right? It's just about the age at which you are. And, you know, people who are older often look back and think these kids have it way too easy, and we'll all be there someday. So try to have a little empathy around that, the generational differences.
Yeah, and this was part of the conversation that I had in the previous part about the creative collaboration, is really understanding the turnings of history and society, and how fascinated I am by these generational gaps. Because if we'd had the internet for the last 500 years, you could find every 10 to 15 years articles on Business Insider that say Gen Z is unhappy in the workplace, millennials aren't happy in the workplace, Gen X is unhappy in the workplace, the silent generation is unhappy in the workplace, right? So the kids these days effect has been going on for hundreds of years. Nothing is new about it. But I'm curious how better understanding the differences and the way that we came up, and whether it doesn't even have to be about the tormentor versus passive aggressive versus all of the other options. There's a lot of nuances in all of them when it is somebody that came up 30 or 40 years ago versus somebody that's coming up today. So how can that kind of be its own kind of framework within a framework with these different archetypes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to think about, there are different, right? We have different life experiences. There's different access to technology. There's different, right? There's all of those differences. And I think you have to really be conscientious that you're not getting so like, this is my experience, this was the right experience. And it's about I asked some of my Gen Z colleagues, I'm like, you know, show me the best TikTok you saw this week, right? And I know I sound old doing, you know, and I know, but it helps me, right? And it helps me understand, and just having conversations with them as people. It's so easy to sit with someone and be like, wow, they're so old, or oh, I'm old, or they're so young, and just to be focused on that, but just try to engage with them as people and recognize, yeah, they're going to have totally different experiences and exposure to different things. And there's different norms. Like my daughter will often be like, why are you mad at me? And I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, you sent that text at a period at the end. I'm like, really? Like, that's angry now? And it's like, she's like, yeah. So like, and I have to laugh at it because it is her experience. And to deny that that's the norm in which she grew up in is just not fair, right? Because it, like you said, 500 years, there's the generation before us, the generation after us, they're having the same judgments.
Yeah. And I've read so many articles that blow my mind about the way to use emojis the right way and the wrong way, and capitalization and punctuation. And I'm like, I'm 100 years old because I capitalize the beginning of a message and I put a period at the end. And that means something to different people in different generations, right? And people know you're old if you use the thumbs up or the smiley face, like, oh my God, I can't believe you thumbsed up me. I'm like, I just meant, hey, got your message. And they're like, oh, you meant this. I'm like, what is happening? Right. So there's a lot of nuance to dig into all of this.
Yeah. And I think that you have to have some self like humor about it, because like, you know, I could sit there going, oh my gosh, you are an idiot. Why are you so upset about a thumbs up? Right. Like that would be a rational way to react, but that's not going to connect me with that person. That's not going to help me understand them. That's not going to help me have a good relationship with them, instead of being like, yep, I'm old, right? Or like, oh gosh, like I didn't even realize that. Thank you for telling me, you know, anything that just sort of makes it clear you're not there to police everyone else's behavior, right? You're there to form connections. Like, to go back to the beginning of our conversation, you're there to have positive working relationships so you can be your most productive, creative self in collaboration with other people.
And it sounds to me like if we were going to look at these eight archetypes, and P.S., spoiler alert, I might add a ninth for you in a second and just completely blow up the whole framework. But it seems to me that the meta skill underneath all of these is empathy. Mm-hmm. It's being able to say to yourself, I understand why you're behaving this way, or I want to, which helps me better understand the intention behind your behavior. Once you get dig into that, you're like, oh, this is maybe more about them than it is about me.
Yes. And I just want to underscore that empathy is not being generous, right? It's not about, oh, let me give them empathy. It's strategic, because the more you understand them, the more you're sort of open to a collaborative, different way of working, the better it's going to be for you. Right. And you should never give someone empathy at the sort of risk of not giving empathy to yourself. But I think it is just such a strategic move to try to understand what's motivating this person, what matters to them. How can I sort of think about that and interact with them in a way that diffuses some of the tension by keeping that in mind?
I've also found that that's really helpful, not just with the person you're interacting with directly, but if you're in a position like me, people are often coming to you saying, oh, this person did this and that, blah, blah, blah. It's always about like, I get why you're upset. Let's try to understand why we think they did that. And once you're like, I think their intentions were actually good. And they're like, yeah, they were. It's still stupid that they said that, but all right, I get why they said that. So I really understanding the intention behind the action, I find can be incredibly helpful, which again, doesn't excuse bad behavior or abuse or anything else, but I at least want to understand it from their perspective. And I think that any creative, whether it's in the work itself, it's in the interaction with other people, you have to develop the skill of empathy.
Yes.
It's not just about how good you are with Photoshop or Premiere or whatever it is. Like, you have to be able to manage these relationships with others.
That's right.
So now I'm going to throw a grenade in your archetype, and you can totally tell me if I'm wrong, but I feel like there's one other kind of conflict style, and I think it might not be in here because it's a lack of conflict style. And I say this because this is a complaint I get a lot from the clients and the students that I work with, is that especially in the remote work environment, I work with a neglector. I'm just sitting there all day long, and all I get are notes in a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet. There's no interaction. There's no relationship. I'm just a keyboard to them. I'm just a button pusher.
Yeah. Yeah.
That lack of conflict is still a tremendous conflict and causes burnout and causes depression and causes people to leave. How can we manage neglectors?
Oh, it's such a good addition to the archetype. It's funny. Sometimes people are like, I have a new archetype. And I'm like, well, that's actually the know-it-all in a different, but this genuinely is a new one. So good on you. You know, I think about this as like the hands-off boss or the hands-off colleague, the person who's just like slippery, like you ask for feedback and it's just like, just sort of like glide, like nothing actually. And you're sitting there waiting, like you need them to do something or you need them to engage and they're just not engaging. The one of the things I'll talk about empathy is think about like what's preventing them from doing it, right? Like, is it lack of interest? Is it lack of time? Do you think there's maybe some insecurity underlying that sort of neglect? And then I think it's about asking for it directly, right? Explaining why, right? Is saying, you know, it's helpful when you put your comments or your notes in the Excel spreadsheet. It's even more helpful when I can sit down and we can hash them out together. Would it be possible to do that? Right. Like just even a direct request and explaining why you want that, right? Of like, it helps me be more creative. I feel like the end product is stronger when we do this or whatever. And I think it's just about asking. Now, you may ask and not get anything. And that's that, you have to accept that. You're not going to draw their engagement out of them. But then the question is, can you get what you need from someone else? That's when I'm dealing with a neglector. I'm not going to, there's no like putting your hand down their throat, pulling out the words that you need, right? Or like needing the validation. So instead think about, is there someone else who can fill that role? And that doesn't mean like sidelining the neglector. It just means, well, maybe I'm not getting the mentorship I need, or maybe I'm not getting the feedback I need. Maybe I'm not getting the validation I need. Is there someone else on this project in my life that I can actually pull in to give me that so that I still get everything I need to do my best work?
I love all of that. Want to end this with one last simple question that frankly, again, could be in another entire episode. And it's, should you quit? At some point, you're going to ask yourself this question. I've done all the things. I've read the book. I've told them they're amazing. I've asked them for what they wanted. Like, I have an entire conversation for 90 minutes with this with Annie Duke already. Oh. So don't feel like you have to cover this entire gap, because she's one of the world's experts, literally has a book called Quit. Yeah. So I'm taking that burden off. I can send people to Annie Duke for 90 minutes. But based on what we've talked about today, how can we use this to determine whether or not it's time to quit?
Yeah, I love Annie's work, by the way. Highly recommend her book. Two things I want to say about quitting. Number one, if you are feeling like when you said earlier, they were literally killing me, right? If you are feeling the physical, mental, emotional effects of stress of interacting with this person, and you've tried multiple things to try to change the dynamic between you and it has failed, it is not worth it to suffer, right? I think that's the first and foremost. If you can, and still, you know, get the income you need, still pay your mortgage, whatever, pay your rent, whatever it is you need, and you can quit, and then please don't torture yourself. I think the connected to that, I will say that I think quitting is both overrated and underrated. I think it's overrated in that we often think, I'm going to quit this, I'm going to move on to the next project. And then you show up and you're like, oh, there's a passive aggressive know-it-all here too. Interesting, right? So I think the grass often seems greener. So you want to really be realistic of, is this specific to this one person? Is this specific to this project? Is this not going to, am I sure this isn't going to happen again? And I think it's also an underrated option in that I think we often think people should just tough it out. And I'm not a big believer in that. Like, I'm not a big, if you are, what I would like people to do is really say, what's making me want to quit, and list out those things. Are any of those things in my control to change, right? Okay, yes, I'll change those things. Can I experiment with changing some of the other things? See if I can nudge this person into being more pleasant, civil, whatever it is, and set a time limit, 6 weeks, 3 months. I'm going to see if I can make progress on these three things. If I can't, then I'm out. In those 3 months, you start working on your resume, networking, whatever it is you need to do to find your next gig so that you are not stuck, because that's the worst piece. I don't want to tell people they're ever stuck. And I think that's because that's when we start, when we don't have that agency, when we don't have the sense that I can take action, I can take positive action, that takes a real toll on us mentally. And I think you have to remember you have agency. There are other things you can do. There are more boundaries you can set. There are hopefully other opportunities you can pursue. You're not stuck, and there is hope, and it's in your control not to change that person, not to change the entire team dynamic, but at least change your mindset and the way you set boundaries around you.
I appreciate the sense of giving somebody some sense of permission, control, and awareness. The only thing that I'll add to it, which I want to be very conscious of your time, and it could end up becoming a whole other conversation, and it doesn't need to be. But if you find yourself going from one job to another, to another, to another, and it's the same problems, might be time to look in the mirror.
Yes. Yes. I couldn't agree more. And I think, and I do talk to people. I remember there's someone in my network who I didn't want to say too much about who this person is, but who, when I was looking for stories for articles or for books, she always had a story about the terrible boss. And I kept thinking, oh, she must be talking about the same boss. And then I realized it was every boss she ever had. Now, I will not deny there are a lot of terrible bosses out there, but to have a track record of zero, right? Zero good bosses seems really unlikely. Ultimately, you have to look at yourself. You have to look at your behavior, how you're reacting, what you're doing to contribute to the dynamic. Because at the end of the day, the thing that's going to the next job is you, right? That person's hopefully not going with you. And so what have you learned? What can you do differently? How can you lay the groundwork to have the best possible relationships with the people you work with?
Oh, my mind is blown from the last 90 minutes or so, and I've learned so much beyond the things that I read and learned about in the book. And I want to make sure that anybody else that is feeling similarly has the opportunity to find the book, subscribe to your newsletter, whatever it might be. What's the kind of most central or best place that you'd like to send people listening today?
My website is the best place to go. It's amyegallo.com. And there is, I send out a bi-monthly newsletter all about positive relationships at work, dealing with conflict, disagreements. So definitely sign up for that. There's also links there too. I've written hundreds of articles for Harvard Business Review. You can find a lot of my work there. You can purchase my book there as well. That's the best place to go.
Well, this was tremendously beneficial to me, to my audience. I just had fun today. This is just a fun conversation. And I'm really thankful that you were willing to take the time out of your calendar and chat with me today and share your years and years of insights with my audience of creatives. So can't thank you enough, Amy.
Thank you, Zach. This has been so pleasant. I honestly, like 90 minutes felt like 9. So we could have kept going.
Thank you so much for investing both your time and energy listening to today's show. If you were inspired by this conversation, don't forget to subscribe in your podcast app of choice, and most importantly, leave a review, because that helps move the show to the top of iTunes and get our message out there to those who need it the most. Simply visit optimizeyourself.me/subscribe to never miss another episode. Lastly, stay safe, healthy, sane, and most importantly, be well. One last thing before I lose you. If you haven't already, I want to make sure that you have subscribed to my free weekly Case of the Mondays newsletter, because it is where I share my best advice, strategies, and mindsets to help you design a creative career that you absolutely love showing up for every Monday morning. When you sign up, I'm even going to send you a bonus 5-day email course to help you clarify and prioritize the next small steps in your unique path to success. To sign up, just visit optimizeyourself.me/newsletter, and I will see you in your inbox.